Hi, I'm Spencer.
And I'm Andrew, and you're listening to the At a Distance podcast from The Slowdown. Today we'll be speaking with Josh Burson. He's an anthropologist and historian whose work focuses on the role of social and cognitive science in shaping our understanding of what it means to be human.
Josh is the author of the new book, The Human Scaffold, How Not to Design Your Way Out of a Climate Crisis, as well as the 2019 book, The Meat Question, Animals, Humans, and the Deep History of Food. He has held appointments at two Max Planck Institutes and at the Berggruen Institute, where he was the inaugural USC Berggruen Fellow in the Transformations of the Human Program.
Through his work, Josh is rigorously investigating and challenging common assumptions, always with a long view, whole earth lens. We're excited to speak to him today. Let's get him on the line. Hi, Josh. Welcome to At a Distance. It's so great to have you with us today.
It's lovely to be here. Thank you.
So, Josh, sometimes we start the show with a really simple question, which is just, what's at the top of your mind right now?
Oh, that it should be a simple question. And yet, let me pivot that to a question that I can answer. And maybe if with time, I'll be able to tell you what's at the top of my mind. I can tell you what I've been reading the past couple days. On the one hand, I've been reading Yoko Tawada's novel, The Emissary, which imagines a future in which Japan has suffered some catastrophe, not unlike the Fukushima Daiichi meltdown, and has isolated itself as a result. And time has gone into reverse, or at least aging has gone into reverse, so that it's septuagenarians, octogenarians, nonagenarians, and centenarians who are the vigorous people. And the newborns come out verbal and very sophisticated, but they're enfeebled. They have no physical vigor. On the other end, I've been reading a new textbook on regression theory, on generalized linear regression and Poisson regression. It just came out. In fact, I've been waiting for it to come into the bookstore for weeks. And just this afternoon, I received a notice that it was in. So I guess what's on the top of my mind is prediction in different ways. You know, the mathematical formalisms that by which we operationalize the act of forecasting something or of predicting the future, of inferring causes when we see a relationship between two phenomena. And on the other end, a more open-ended kind of prediction, not so much prediction as speculation about different possible futures.
Mm. And of course, so much of this has to do with the larger moment we're in. I mean, as a whole earth, we're clearly not, you know, past the pandemic, but I was curious from you how you would describe the moment we're in, at least in America or broadly in the world right now.
Well, it's funny, you know, I'm in Berlin today, and the situation in Germany looks quite a bit different to what it looks like in America or even other parts of Europe. Right now, here, it's pretty relaxed. I'd say the mood it's not ebullient, but the whole way through, since I returned to Germany last October, there's been a certain workmanlike vibe. Mm. The pandemic has not felt terribly dramatic. It's been tedious at times, and it's been challenging in various ways, but it has not felt like the existential crisis that it certainly did in New York, where I spent the better part of last year.
Mm.
So what the mood is like in America, from what I know from talking to friends there and reading and speculating, my own feeling about America is one of anxiety, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Not even so much with respect to the public health situation. The performance of frontline healthcare workers in the U.S. last year was by and large exemplary. The failures were, on the one hand, failures of leadership, and on the other hand, were more like active derelictions of leadership. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, the more or less predictable product of 40 years of treating healthcare as a just-in-time commodity. So I'm not actually so anxious about the public health situation in the U.S., or at least not more anxious than I ordinarily would be. We're not public health in the strict sense, public health in the sense we imagine when we think about infectious diseases.
More in the bigger picture of public health.
Yeah, I'm concerned with a certain epistemic nihilism that continues in the States, you know, notwithstanding the changes of the past 8 months.
You know, you recently published this book, The Human Scaffolding, How Not to Design Your Way Out of a Climate Crisis. So I just wanted to start, before we get too much into the book, with just the title.
Sure.
Which I'm sure was not flippantly arrived at. So can you explain to me what the title connotes, what it means to you, and sort of how you came to it?
This title was a dark horse for most of the time that I was writing the book. So when it was one of the things we tossed around as an early idea for a title. But for most of the time that I was writing the book, I thought of the project as ditch kit. So a ditch kit is a bag that you might keep in the cockpit of a small aircraft. So if you have to ditch, right, you have stuff with you, or a comparable idea would be a bug out bag, right? A bag that you keep on hand packed in your home so that if you have to leave.
It was your go bag title.
Right, your go bag. Right. So the working title of the book was Ditch Kit. And I thought of it as very much about this kind of metaphoric extension of the ditch kit to our whole way of life. Like, what is the minimal viable strategy for getting living in the world? And what happens if we apply this perspective to strategies of getting a living that are alien to our own, you know, that are distant in time and space, maybe that we can only observe through archaeological evidence and so on. But when I proposed the book, or the first time I proposed the book, not to the publisher, but to the Berggruen Institute, when they were putting together the cohort for the inceptive year of the Transformations of the Human program in late 2017, I proposed it under the title The Scaffold. What I had in mind was what in the philosophy of biology is sometimes referred to as an evolutionary scaffold. In other words, an apparatus, and it could be material, or it could be behavioral or environmental, or it could be a combination of all three, that serves both as a support and as a constraint for some other set of behaviors, some repertoire of behaviors. So it's the same as the word scaffold is used in tissue generation science or cell-cultured meat, right? So when you think of how tissues are cultured, they're generally grown on some kind of scaffold. Or when you think of the way organs are grown for organ replacement, they have to be grown on some kind of armature, some kind of support, which sometimes is later removed and sometimes is incorporated into the final product. And the idea of an evolutionary scaffold, or of a scaffold in particular for cultural evolution in humans, did not originate with me. You know, I was building on the work of a number of philosophers of biology, in particular William Wimsatt and Kim Sterelny. And Wimsatt, Sterelny, and a number of others, Peter Godfrey Smith, have been working with the concept of an evolutionary scaffold under that term and under other terms for decades. But it has not been brought to bear quite so directly on cultural evolution in humans in the past. Nor has it really been made accessible, and nor have its implications for concepts that generally are not treated under the philosophy of biology, but more in anthropology and evolutionary anthropology and cultural anthropology, been drawn out. And so I wanted to do a bit of that in the book. I didn't want it to be a disciplinary book, but I wanted to explore the relationship between ideas that had grown up in one field and problems that had arisen in another field. And in that respect, the concept of a scaffold seemed useful. But it also, like most evolutionary scaffolds, I thought of it as something that would go away once I had got the thing itself up. And over time, talking to people, to interlocutors at the Berggruen, I came to see that a big part of what had attracted them to the project was this concept of a scaffold, and that it was not as widely known as I had thought. So I began to develop it more and to make its development and make its opposition to another common metaphor of adaptation, the landscape, more thematic in the book. Mm. And so that's why in the end, when we were going through possible titles about 2 years ago, we decided to stick with the scaffold and the human scaffold in particular. And of course, it also has the dual sense that there are scaffolds that you use to construct things, and then there are also scaffolds that you use to hang someone.
Yeah.
Right. So there is a bit of wordplay. As for the subtitle.
Yeah, that's what I was almost more curious about.
Yeah. So my aim with the subtitle was I did want to do something that would be a bit flippant and that would also communicate to potential readers that this was not a dry textbook. This was not a book just for specialists. At the same time, I wanted to signal to potential audiences in the design field that this is a book that might have relevance for them. Mm. In the preface, in the introductory chapter, I talk about how one of the books that this book is not is a kind of critical history of how design became a form of consulting, or after some fashion, how design ate management consulting, right? Or how design went from being about the constraints and affordances of tables and chairs and cars to the constraints and affordances of municipal government or hospital workflow or end-of-life care, right? In 2013, I gave a talk at the Munich offices, and I use the term office as opposed to studio very pointedly, of IDEO. And part of the chum, part of the swag they gave me at the end of the talk was a copy of Tim Brown's Change by Design, which is a participant's history, an actor's history of this very process. And so for me, this was a primary text, and I was fascinated by how not just IDEO, but other firms in the space have represented themselves. And I've been following these firms and this story in a way since about 1990. I think it was around, say, when I was about 15, I got my hands on a copy of Graphis, which at the time was the apical periodical in communications design.
Yeah, totally.
And for a while, I even had a subscription. And I remember sometime early on in there, you know, 1993, 1994, they did a feature, essentially an advertisement for Frog. It was about a set of motorcycles or concept automobiles that Frog had designed. And in the years since, it became known to people outside the design world for the design of the original Palm Pilot handset, right? You wouldn't even call it a handset. It simply was the Palm Pilot, right? It wasn't connected to anything.
Yeah.
And the fact that they had succeeded with this handheld stylus design where Apple had failed with the Newton. So I've been thinking for about 7 years about how what we think of today as design ethnography has revived that process, and thinking about what its implications are for how we make knowledge about the world, in particular parts of the world that are inaccessible, both logistically inaccessible or inaccessible by virtue of the fact that they're in the past and we can only know them through their debris, or perhaps inaccessible because they're in the future and we can only know them from speculation. So I wanted to signal with the subtitle, to bring it back to your question, that on the one hand, this was a book that would be sort of gently, teasingly critical of the strategic turn in the design world.
This is not the first time a guest on one of our programs has basically been critical of IDEO and bullshit design thinking, you know, and the false promise that, or the mislabeling of that as actual anthropological work.
Yeah.
And the dangers of that.
That's really what the book is about, that we shouldn't be thinking about design as a solution to the carbon crisis or anything else, as a response to the carbon crisis or anything else, as about making things. Mm-hmm. That ultimately design is about managed deliquescence, managed unwinding. You know, it's about what happens when things inevitably fall apart. Right. And I don't just mean designing for failover, designing things to be fail soft. I mean designing knowing that everything eventually will in the really long game falls apart.
Yeah. Which is different from planned obsolescence. And also this idea that we are selling an absolute utopia or an absolute solution. I mean, it's like a 1950s appliance idea, which carried through the mid-aughts, certainly with big companies in the Valley that kind of said, this will change everything, or this will fix things. And I think that what's so beautiful about the way you're looking at it is maybe we shouldn't be thinking about it that way.
Oh my goodness, there is so much grade inflation in the way we talk about the value of different kind of interventions. That for me, ultimately, it comes down to a certain presentism. And maybe that's why my big intervention, to a certain degree in my first book, but really in The Meat Question and definitely in The Human Scaffold, and in the next couple books that I'm roughing in at the moment, is really about taking the very long view, mm-hmm. you know, and encouraging other people to take the very long view. Mm. The view in which that's indifferent to us, you know, the view in which we cease to matter. Mm. What if we imagine our long game not as one of survival or of continuation, not as one of preserving the us, of extending our lives either as individuals or as a form of life, but as some kind of leaving a trace, leaving a trace and then disappearing.
Mm. Well, during the writing of the book, you note that you began to pay more attention to fashion.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you just, you know, why?
Well, there were a couple of reasons. When I wrote my first book, Computable Bodies, I was nominally attached to a research group at the Max Planck Institute for Human Cognitive and Brain Sciences. And in that kind of environment, people generally pay very little attention to what they're wearing. Right. I was also spending most of my time in The Hague at a design studio called Lust, which was very well known in the communications design world at the time and has now undergone its own kind of transformation. So they closed in 2017 when one of their founders and my main counterpart there, Dimitri Nievenhuizen, died, unfortunately, at a young age. Though they have a successor studio also in The Hague, Render. But so I was going back and forth between these two worlds. But as it turned out, even at Lust, you know, there wasn't a lot of premium placed on how you dressed. You know, some people were interested in looking good, others were not. And I, most of the time in these years, both when I was writing that first book and when I was writing the Meat Question, I was left to my own devices. So by the time I was finishing Computable Bodies, actually, I was commuting between Berlin and London and managing parts of a project at Wellcome Trust. And so there would be a period, you know, a few days or a week or two at the most every month when I had to show up at an office in Euston in the center of London and look modestly presentable because our grant makers would make frequent appearances in our studios. But when I was at home, which was a lot of the time, I wore what was comfortable. And I'd started thinking more about how to dress or rather how to pack some years earlier, because I was moving around a lot and you want to make sure that you don't need to carry too much, as I talk about in the book. So already by then I'd started to think, well, if I needed to look presentable and I could only had a few things with me, right? Or if I was only carrying a few things from one place to another, what would they be? So already by, say, 2014, 2015, I was thinking that way. But it was when I got to Los Angeles that I really had to take matters in hand. And it wasn't so much because I was in Los Angeles as opposed to Berlin, mm-hmm. but because I actually had to make myself presentable, you know, to be in an office and participate in colloquia on a regular basis. And this was a very good thing. I'd certainly not been inured to the allure of clothing previously, but it forced me to think systematically about, well, how can you reconcile the different roles that clothing has to play, the functional role, right? Mm. And protection from the elements and so on, the signaling roles that you play a certain role, that you expect to be treated a certain way, right? How can you reconcile those with one another and also with an abiding desire not to have too much stuff?
Yeah.
You know? It wasn't that I wanted to collect clothing. It was that I didn't want to. I wanted not to have to think about it. But in not thinking about it, I wanted to be able to know that whatever I had on would be okay. Mm-hmm. It started there in a way. It started simply with the practical needs of professional relationship management. But then, of course, it became part of the book, not simply because it was on my mind for other reasons, but because I was writing about people who lived without a lot of clothing in cold places and in times when it was colder there than it is now. So Tasmania, 40,000 years ago, was 6 or 7 degrees Celsius, or, you know, say 12, 13 degrees Fahrenheit, colder on average than it is now, or than it was, say, 10, 20 years ago, using that as a baseline, because it's probably a bit warmer now. And yet, there's remarkably little archaeological evidence of the use of clothing. Certainly, at the peak of the cold era, just before the onset of the Holocene, there are signs that the people there were making fitted cloaks from wallaby skins. But after the climate got milder, but while it was still not a place you'd want to spend the full year, certainly not the winter, without clothing, clothing seems to become less important to people there. Mm. And in the early chapters of the book, where I'm writing about how Tasmania has become, and again, I use the phrase pointedly, a poster child for the challenges that small populations face in maintaining a technological toolkit, a ditch kit, and a minimal viable adaptive strategy over time. The absence of clothing from the archaeological record and from the ethnographic record, the fact that European visitors to Tasmania starting in the 17th century record a marked absence of clothing, is one of the things that investigators have pointed to as a sign that something had gone wrong in the transmission of technical culture in Tasmania. And I was very much concerned when I was writing these chapters to push back against this view. In fact, I'd been planning this for years. I didn't know how I was going to do it. Mm. And I'd been thinking for years, I have to write about this. This is so wrong. So early on, I knew, independent of the fact that it was becoming a preoccupation of mine in my own personal life, that I wanted to understand more about the archaeology of clothing, but also mm-hmm. about how we think about clothing today and how we use clothing.
Right. I mean, one area that you have formed a particular interest in is Boro from Japan.
Yeah.
What appeals about that to you? And also, I guess, just connected to that, I know you've spent a lot of time in Japan, and Japanese culture in general seems to have a large influence on your thinking. Could you talk about Boro and also just sort of Japanese culture at large and how it frames your views?
I don't want to deny that I've come to have a certain, I don't know if fascination is the word, but I've taken an interest, an ethnographic interest in craft culture in Japan. And I would not say that I've spent a lot of time in Japan. I've spent at this point, I think all of 3 months in Japan, though I do hope to rectify that in the not too distant future. But in some ways, it's similar to what keeps attracting me to Australia. Some of this is imprinting and some of it is idiosyncratic, but there's a quality of facture. There's a quality to the way things are made and to not so much the way knowledge is reproduced, but to how material things become media of the making of knowledge and of the making of meaning, that there's a factor to that process, to the way that material things become media of meaning, let's say, in Japan, that I find distinctly appealing. I guess, Boro, the phenomenon you refer to, which was a way of patching clothing that was not uncommon in late Edo Japan, but it was a strategy of making do because you didn't have a lot of clothing, right? And if you were a farmer, if you were a peasant, your clothing was going to get torn up on a regular basis and you would simply repair it with overstitch or patching. And lately, I've noticed in a number of Japanese labels and labels influenced by Japan, there's been kind of a valorization of Boro as an aesthetic. And I have, as I say in the preface, mixed feelings about this, because on the one hand, it could be read as a class device. On the other hand, more charitably, you could read it as a strategy of designing for disintegration. If something is patched by design, that serves as kind of a scaffold or a crutch to help you accept the fact that it's going to change as it ages.
Yeah.
This book went through 6 rounds of outside review. Wow. There was an initial external peer review, and then 3 rounds, just one-on-one back and forth with the commissioning editor, and then a second round of external peer review with 2 reports, and then a final round from the editorial board of the Faculty Senate at the University of California, which is a standard procedure for a University of California press, that the editorial board of the Faculty Senate gets final say. So there were a lot of people with a lot of different ideas about what this book should be, and a lot of different forms of expertise. And there may be one person's name on the cover, but a book like this, or really any book, is the product of an extended process of negotiation. Mm. So there were places in the text when I patched the text to reflect the conversations I'd been having with early readers. And I wanted that to be something that readers would see. You know, I wanted to bring that out into the open, not as some kind of demonstrative metafictional device, but because I felt it might help readers understand, you know, how knowledge gets made, and why I wrote the first half of the book the way I did. That my skepticism about claims that had been published by other respectable investigators was not a form of nihilism or meliorism, but that this is just how we learn to fail better.
Well, it's like Kintsugi. I mean, they cracked it and you filled it in with gold. and there's a certain beauty to that.
There is a certain beauty to that, but you have to be careful because with Kintsugi, it's not designed to be functional afterward. Sometimes it is, but it's kind of it's an aesthetic gesture. It's it's an instance of mono no aware, you know, the pathos of things, right? Mm. And I'm very much in favor of patchiness, but I feel like mono no aware shades over into exactly the kind of sentimentalism that I'd like to avoid. I want to see, you know, like a saiwa no aware, you know, a joyfulness in watching things fall apart.
I guess that's the perspective you bring. I mean, I find the repair with gold to be quite beautiful and love the cup that I'm drinking out of even more so, as it testifies to it, the experience that it's had and the longevity that it can have.
I mean, I'm drinking from a chipped cup as we speak, and it does take practice, ongoing practice, to respect the chip as part of what's good about the cup.
There are a couple other things we wanted to speak to you about. One of them was food. You know, we've mentioned this a bit, and you've written extensively on the human history with meat and challenged assumptions that we hold about our need for it. Can you take us through some of your thinking about meat today?
I'm going to start very quickly by tacking back to things, but there is a method here. So a couple of weeks back, the economist Branko Milanović published a pair of editions of his newsletter offering a critique of degrowth and circular economy thinking. He makes some valid points, but at the end, really, his concern is not so much that steady-state economics would make it impossible to reduce inequality. His concern is more simply that it's not possible.
Right.
That insatiable need is an innate dimension of who we are. And he simply cannot imagine a future in which we don't have that insatiable need. And I read this and I thought, you know, and yet 30 years ago, most informed observers would have said the same thing about meat eating, or 5 years ago. Mm. And some days I would still say the same thing about meat eating. But when I first started working on the meat question, and again, it was a long time in the making. So going back again, say 2011, 2012, I could not have imagined the kind of tipping point that came just as the book came out. And initially, the book was a long time being sold. And 30 or more editors said, there is no market for a book about the intersection of race, capitalism, and meat eating. Then, of course, the book came out, and 3 months later, we were in a zoonotic pandemic. But I'm not ready to say that we've passed peak meat.
Mm.
I'm not a huge fan of a lot of the would-be successors to meat. Though I have noticed a change just in the past couple of years, just since Beyond had its IPO in the thinking even of certain of my colleagues in this space. There are all kinds of arguments you can make about it and all kinds of arguments you can make against it. But if your main market is still feedstock for landless livestock agriculture, including aquaculture, then you're not really promoting systemic change. So I think there's going to be an ebb in what some people would like to think of as progress on the arc toward a post-meat world.
Hmm. Yeah, no, that's very specifically what I was curious about, you know, how you're feeling about Impossible Meats and this just general moment, which was not part of when you wrote the book.
It was coming toward the end. That book was written very much in dialogue with Ben Wergaft, whose book Meat Planet, which is a 6-year field study of the cultured meat startup scene, came out at the same time as mine did. So it was kind of in the back of my head, but I made a decision, as I discuss in the epilogue to that book, not to focus on that, in part because it was not yet salient to the discussions I was having. I mean, the main argument I wanted to make there is that dispossessed animals and dispossessed humans find themselves occupying coordinate roles of subjection in a single apparatus of economic violence. It's not really interesting to me to see people get righteous about giving up meat in the affluent world, or to talk about the desire for meat as a form of ideological bias, as carnism, right? Because that doesn't really address the concerns that animate the protein strategies of precarious migrant workers in other parts of the world.
Now that you've finished writing The Human Scaffold, and you've also written The Meat Question, what do you think the environmental crisis demands of us to reconsider in terms of you know, how we're living at this moment in time? I think connected to that, which is a central question in your book, is what to you is the good life? So it's sort of twofold question here, you know, what is the environmental crisis demanding in terms of how we live, and what to you really is the good life?
Spencer, I'll start just by jumping back to the earlier question about the subtitle, because there was one way in which I felt uncomfortable with the subtitle and still do, which is that word crisis. By framing something in terms of a crisis, we imagine a future that can't possibly be different. We sort of hollow out the future if we think of ourselves as being in a constant crisis. So if a crisis can be thought of as not an event type thing, but an extended phenomenon, okay, you know, if a crisis is an extended disequilibrium, what does the environmental crisis demand of us, and what is the good life? You know, it demands more of us than anyone, certainly I, is willing to recognize just yet. I mean, we will eventually, some of us. Again, I'm always chary of using this big we, because the big we sort of flattens out all the unequal distributions of power that affect who exactly is going to be forced to make major changes in their life. It's not going to be by and large the people who, while it would be an abuse of attribution to say they caused the crisis through their personal behavior, are certainly, let's say, more complicit in it through the endowments that they, and through the accidents of life history that have given them the lives they have. So what it demands of us, I don't like to frame it as Michael Pollan puts it, a challenge of lifestyle, right? Mm-hmm. It's not a crisis of lifestyle. To think of it that way, to think of it as a challenge of consumer preferences, is exactly the opposite of the way I want to frame it, though I'm aware how easy it is to read, especially this last book, through that lens. But it does demand that we recalibrate our appreciation of what is comfortable and what it means to abide. And I guess to speak to your second question, the personal mm-hmm. question, what for me is the good life? You know, I have to say I feel really privileged, and I try to express gratitude for this every day, but I lead a really good life at the moment. And of course there are things that I'd like to see different. I mean, a good life for me is one in which I get to spend a lot of my time doing stuff like this, or better still, in written form, you know, where I can shut myself mm-hmm. away for 3 hours every morning and just make stuff up. I think that's something we could all aspire to. You know, a good life is a life in which what you do for a living, as it were, is not the center of your social identity, unless you choose to make it so.
Mm. As we're emerging out of this moment and into the next, what is your greatest hope, you know, specifically within the context of coming out of this pandemic?
My greatest hope, I'll try to be modest, you know, in the spirit of Bordeaux, of theoretical modesty. My greatest hope is that let's limit it even further, say to the United States, is that it would lead to systematic reform in how Americans view health, that will lead to greater respect and greater awareness of immunodiversity, right? Mm-hmm. That perhaps immunodiversity will be the next neurodiversity, that it would lead to a change in how we regard care as a kind of work, right? That we would begin to understand that there's no higher form of work than caring for one another. Mm. You know, already I'm not terribly optimistic that hope will be fulfilled. I think this is not the last infectious pandemic we'll see in our lifetimes. Though I'm in some ways more concerned with the non-infectious ones. You know, like when thunderstorm asthma is something that it's not just people in Melbourne, but people everywhere are aware of, right? Because of changes in the stoichiometry of the troposphere. So my greatest hope is that it leads to a longer view of the relationship between environment and health in a broader view. It's a hope, you know, it's not a conviction. You know, it's not something I think is going to happen.
Mm-hmm. We can hope. Josh, thank you so much for joining us today. This was just an incredibly invigorating conversation. We loved hearing from you.
It's been a privilege. Thank you both.
Thanks for listening. To hear more episodes of At a Distance, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. You can follow us on Instagram at slowdown.tv. To sign up for our weekly newsletter, Exploring the Five Senses, head to our website at www.slowdown.tv.